Morning. I know it's like still a minute to go or 30 seconds to go, but I like to be on time. My mother taught me to be on time. It's one of the few things. All right, I guess we'll get started, even though I think it's about exactly 9 o'clock. All righty, I was just saying if there's any empty seats for the people that walk in, there's no need to stand in the back. My name is Stephen Forte, and we are going to be talking about agile estimation. And these bother me, so I'm going to do that. I want to ask the audience a few questions before we get started. The first question is, how many folks in the room are using Agile in their projects today? Just do a quick show of hands. Okay, what I expected, almost 100%. And I'm guessing that the people who didn't raise their hand were busy tweeting or something like that. I used to actually hate when people would tweet during sessions. I figured they weren't engaged, but I think kind of like the self-promotion side to me says tweet all you want about the session. So I've done a change of pace on that. And the other question I have is how many folks are doing some form of dynamic estimation, at like what we would call kind of agile estimation? Okay, so probably a little more, about 25% of the room. And just more for my own education, this has nothing really to do with the course because this works with all forms. How many people are using XP as their primary methodology? Only like 1 or 2, which is probably like 1 or 2%. And how many people are using Kanban? Or I'm American, we say Kanban. Kanban? All right, so probably about 10% of the room. And I'm assuming everyone else is using Scrum or some variant of Scrum. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, great. So as I said before, this will be about agile estimation, specifically about making it work. So we'll spend a fair amount of time on the theory and the process to get everyone rolling. And then we will actually roll up the sleeves. Well, my sleeves are already rolled up. But we will roll up the sleeves and kind of get a little down and dirty. And we'll do it in Excel, so no fancy project management software or things like that. And I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. Oh, there's a clicker, even better. So as I said, I'm Steve. And I am from New York City. And I was born and raised in New York City. So if you think I'm like a loud, rude American, don't hold the Americans accountable. It's really the New York thing. And we actually take pride in being loud in New York and rude. And actually, no one's really all that rude in New York. But my fast pace of speaking, my kind of personality is a very New York personality, as I said, born and raised in New York. However, for the last 5 years, I've been living in Hong Kong, hence the Hong Kong Rugby 7 jersey. Whenever I talk about agile, I always like to wear a rugby jersey. I think in New Zealand, it's more than appropriate. And it's funny, I actually, I've been to New Zealand when I was a kid, when I was about 17. And I saw the All Blacks play in Australia. And I've always been an All Blacks fan. And what's interesting is I wrote something on Twitter, like, you know, heading down to New Zealand this week. And one of my friends from Hong Kong said, they hate rugby and they hate beer. He goes, you're going to have a miserable time there. So, but I've been living in Hong Kong for about 5 years. And I've been doing a lot of work these days with startups, mostly because I run the startup accelerator that's based in Hong Kong, called Accelerator HK. We've had two batches. If you're not familiar with the accelerator model, we make an equity investment in each company, and you take between 6 and 10, I call them teams because they're really barely companies when they start the accelerator program. We make an investment in each company, put them through a 14-week program, and we teach them something called customer development, which in my opinion is agile development for business people. And we actually force a lot of the agile methodology down on the developers on those teams. And then at the end of this 14-week program, there is a demo day where everyone makes a presentation. If you're interested by any stretch of the imagination, you could just Google it, Accelerate HK. We have all the teams have a YouTube video with their presentations. I work for a company called Telerik, which you might have heard of. It's a developer tools, probably one of the leading .NET tools vendors. And we've been putting on these accelerators to engage in the audiences since we sell into the enterprise and we sell to small teams. We've put it on to engage with the startups. I myself have done several startups in the past before I got to Telerik, so that's one of the reasons why they put me in charge. But if you really want to know the real reason, I just realized I'm being recorded, but don't tell anyone else this, is I just rose my hand one day in a meeting and said, it'd be cool if we did an accelerator. And they were like, okay, you're in charge. That's really kind of how the decisions get made there. One other important note is I am on the board of directors of the Scrum Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization that teaches Scrum to people, certifies people. So if you're a certified Scrum Master and you took a certified Scrum Master class, chances are you're a member of the Scrum Alliance and don't even know it. And I was actually the elected on the board of directors. So thank you for voting for me, I guess, 2 years ago. So let's get started. It's just, again, the show of hands. A lot of people have also entered while I did the introduction. Is how many people reprioritize and reestimate the entire project at the end of every sprint? Okay, so about five people in the room. Because that, in essence, is what we'll be talking about, is the methodology of agile estimation. And I'm going to ask one more show of hands question. I can't promise I won't ask any more, because I know it's early in the morning. And the question I have is really three parts. Is how many people here are independent contractors? You work at a shop where you're writing software, either by the hour, or time and materials, or fixed price for somebody else. Okay, not that many, actually, maybe less than 10% of the room. How many people work at a company? You know, fairly big company, you know, okay. Almost everyone, actually. So then the last question is, how many people like me work at an ISV, right, writing software? I guess that's a company as well, okay, a handful. So almost everyone in the room is writing software for themselves or for internal consumption. Do I get that right? Right, internal consumption. Good, because, well, not as many people rose their hand when I said work at a big company, but I'll take the raise your hand fatigue, I guess. I know it's early. And I say that a few times because usually I'm asleep at this hour because it's like 4 a.m. in Hong Kong. The reason why I ask that is a lot of times I do this session and people come up to me and say, oh, I work at a software design shop or development shop, and we can't use this methodology. Or they say, I work at an ISV, like Telerik, which is my company. We can't use this methodology. And my answer to that is actually you can. So some people like to tune out from the early, like, oh, this doesn't apply to me, I'm a consultant. This doesn't apply to me, I'm at an ISV. But since most of the room is the exact target of agile estimation, it doesn't matter. But for those 5 or 10% of you that were ISVs or contractors, it's definitely applicable. And I'll mention about how it is or how it isn't later on. So I like to start this particular session with the definition of estimation, which is a little weird. And the reason is because more for you to have some ammunition when you try to sell this to senior management, because selling agile estimation at TechEd is fairly easy. You guys are going to be like, amen, brother, right, and leave the room. Hold on real quick. Anyone with an empty seat next to them, raise your hand, because there's about 3 or 4 people in the back. Look at all your new friends, guys in the back. There's no reason for you guys to stand. It's technically a fire hazard. I just say that because if there's a fire, I have to run. Actually, I go out this door, so you guys can stand there all you want. So the definition of estimation, which I lifted right out of Wikipedia, is critical because we've all faced this problem, right? It's the calculated approximation of a result, which is usable, okay, even if the input data is incomplete or uncertain. So literally, by definition, estimates are wrong, right? There is uncertainty built into the textbook definition of an estimation. The problem, as I have in the bullet, is that it becomes this unbreakable schedule where any deviation is considered bad. And what do I mean by that? Is I wonder if any of you have had a similar situation. You are in a meeting, or not even in a meeting, an impromptu meeting. Worse, you're at lunch with someone you consider your friend, the head of marketing. Actually, even worse, you're having a beer with the head of marketing, because now you really can't be held accountable, right? And they start telling you about this brand new project that they're dreaming of. And they say, blah, 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 and it's a website, and it has to be blue. And, you know, and we have to have, it has to be scalable, right? Because, and it has to be responsive design, because they, you know, they just throw out the terms that they hear if they've read TechCrunch or something. And they say, how long is it going to take? Like, you've literally talked about it over one beer. What do you usually say? 2 weeks. Well, perfect example. You've had a beer and you said 2 weeks. What does that now become? The deadline, right? If you're not drunk, I would assume you would say 2 weeks if you were drunk, right? If you're not drunk, you would give a range. I have no idea. We need to talk about the requirements. This might take anywhere between X and Y, right? You would give a range. And, you know, if the marketing manager doesn't push too hard, you can get away with that. The problem is our first guesses, our first estimates are always wrong, but they become the deadline. The reason why I asked if you're an ISV or a consultant is a lot of times you're given the deadline. And all of this applies to that. And I will address that towards the end when we start getting into the math and we power up Excel. But by definition, an estimate is wrong. It's inaccurate. And what's interesting is I was actually in university. I majored in, oh goodness, I have a lot of useless degrees. I have 2 undergraduate degrees and 2 graduate degrees. And my undergraduate degrees, I have a master or a business, or what is, no, no, those are master's degrees. It's political science and history. And you would think having a history degree is useless in a high-tech industry. But in reality, it's not. Because, you know, as they say, history's doomed to repeat itself. It is in learning a little bit of history of our industry works really well. Because there's this guy named Steve McConnell, and he has dug up. He's not really around as much as he used to be. He was big in the 90s and the last decade. But he's dug up a lot of the history. And over the course of, since the 1950s forward, when you come up with an estimate, it is always off by a factor of 4. Which means if at the bar with the marketing head of marketing, and they asked you how long would the project be, and let's just say you were hedging, and you really thought in your mind it was 2 weeks, but then you had the little voice in the back of your head, hey, I'm drunk, I might as well say 1 year. Your initial estimate will be off by a factor of 4, which means it's either going to be 4 years or 3 months. Right? Almost never is it off by the minus, right? Like, if you're consistently off by the minus factor of 4, jobs at Telerik.com. You'll immediately become a manager. Or vice president, whatever title you want, except chief strategy officer, because that's my fancy title. So the problem that Steve McConnell dug up from all the researchers, and these are the researchers like DeMarco, if you ever read any of the history, it's fun stuff, like a book called Peopleware, all these fun books that, you know, as I said, these are written in the 50s and the 60s, is that as the estimate, I'm sorry, your estimate will get better as time progresses. Meaning is you will learn more about the project. So traditionally, we spend a tremendous amount of time working on a specification. Right? So we all know about Waterfall. And let me ask the question, is anyone here still using Waterfall? Okay, a little more than I thought. Actually, more people using Waterfall than XP are about the same as Kanban. This will still work with Waterfall, as long as you adopt Agile. But the problem we had with Waterfall was that we spent a tremendous amount of time building a specification. And the reason why we did that, and I always say one of the benefits of Waterfall and the whole kind of PMI approach, is that it was built during an era when software is very expensive. We were literally using software to put a man on the moon. Right? So it was life, because hardware was very expensive, so the only people who could write software were big government agencies and expensive banks. So software was extremely expensive in the 1950s and 1960s, even into the 1970s and 80s, until client-server came. And so Waterfall was designed to mitigate risk. The sole purpose of Waterfall was to eliminate as much risk as humanly possible. Where flip to 2013, where software's cheap and fast and inexpensive to build, you could afford to make a mistake and throw away a week of work, right, as a learning exercise. Where there was no such thing as a fast iteration on a mainframe in the 1950s, right? Throwing away a week of work, you know, would have been millions of dollars, where now it's just the salaries of the people for the 1 week. So with Waterfall, we spent all this time writing specifications, and we hand it off to developers and they work on it. And what, you know, Steve McConnell and the researchers have figured out that as time progressed, they learned more about the project, obviously, but the estimates became far more accurate. So they've plotted this on a graph, and some of you may have seen this before, so I apologize if you have, but I show it at all the sessions. It's called the cone of uncertainty. And if you haven't seen the cone of uncertainty, it does have the potential to be a little eye-opening. The cone of uncertainty states the following. I don't know if I have a laser pointer here. I think I do. Yes. So at the initial start of a project, you're off by a factor of plus or minus 4. There should be a dot in front of that 25. I apologize. It's probably my fault. I would love to blame it on the projection system, but I probably forgot it. Because So that would mean if it's a one-year project, times it by 0.25 would be 3 months, or one-year estimate would be 4 years. As time progresses in your project, your estimates get better. So like after a sprint or two, you're only off by a factor of 2. And then after a couple more, you're off by a factor of, 0.1, then 0.5, blah, 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 blah. Until you get that really, really fine estimate when you are complete. And I see a couple people chuckling because you're obviously software veterans. Anyone in this circumstance, you wake up in the morning, you say, you kiss your wife or your husband, you say, loved one, I'm going to work and today we're releasing. Meet me at the pub at 5 for the party. Everyone knows where this is going, right? Somewhere around 9 or 10 p.m., you're like, get the phone call. Where are you? Like, I'm drunk with my girlfriends, you're not at the pub. Oh, crap, yeah, we're good. We're going to release a little later today because we're releasing today. And then, you're coding away, and then you're like, it's way past midnight Auckland time. So then you're like, well, it's still today in Europe. And a lot of our customers are in Europe, so we're good. And then, you keep following the sun around the globe. Well, in the States now, it's still, now it's, 6 in the morning here in Auckland. Be like, oh, yeah, but it's still release day in the U.S., right? And then, of course, you start going pretty much to, Hawaii, which is, I guess, the next time zone over in the opposite direction, right? So, and then, has that ever happened to anybody? Okay, so 5 or 10 people just rose their hand. The other 95 people are just lying or embarrassed. So what does that tell us? That tells us that on the day you're supposed to release, your estimate is still inaccurate. Okay? Now, you would think that this is a bad thing. And it is a bad thing. We can't estimate, right? I mean, I don't know if bad's the right word. My argument, and the kind of the whole argument of agile estimation, is use this to your advantage. Meaning is, after a few, this, as I said, this chart was built in the 1950s and is accurate today. Meaning it was built during an era of waterfall, and in the age of XP, Scrum, Kanban, it's still accurate. Which it's one of the few things that transcends waterfall and agile. So when you go to the boss and you actually start selling them on agile estimation, what we're going to spend the rest of the session on, when you start selling the boss on agile estimation, what they'll start to realize is you'll tell them, Let's use the cone of uncertainty to our advantage. Because you'll say to them, every project, we start the project and we blow our estimates by a factor of 4. And they're like, yeah. And they go, why do you think this project's going to be different? Of course, they're going to say, plan better. And you say, we've been saying this for 50 years. So instead, I say, use the cone to your advantage. I've done this lecture many, many times. I'm a Pluralsight author. I've done this session on Pluralsight. If you have a Pluralsight subscription, you can have the pleasure of listening to me yet again, which is probably not mind-numbingly boring. But what's interesting is I've done this at code camps and user groups, and they said every time I say the word cone of uncertainty, they would have to have a drink. So every time I say cone of uncertainty, you guys can like clap or do something silly, because apparently I say it a lot in these sessions. But here's the thesis of agile estimation, is that our estimates are uncertain, we know that, and instead of having this fixed date with this fixed deadline, which, says let's just go in stone, let's reprioritize the backlog and re-estimate at the end of every iteration. So as we do an iteration, let's use the cone of uncertainty to our advantage and say, well, we know that we're going to be off. You guys are good. Let's use this mathematical representation graph to our advantage. Yeah, I'm going to say it at least one more time. I know. You guys are going to bust me. So let's use this to our advantage. And if we're honest with ourselves and we know that at the beginning of the project we're going to be off by a big factor, then we can plan better. And then only after 2 or 3 sprints we can start giving you estimates that actually mean something, because we're going to be only off by a factor of potentially 1. And I know it's a tough sell, but this is actually the methodology that works the best with Agile. As I said, we use the chart I just showed you to your advantage. So how do we do that? So we'll spend the next 15, 20 minutes talking about how to do it, and then we'll round out the rest of the hour today with, as I said, I'll pull up Excel and show you some, project managers like to see numbers and they like to see predictions, and I'll show you my spin on the agile estimation methodology. So how to estimate? It's pretty straightforward. There's really about 5 or 6 steps. I'm going to walk you through all of them, and some of them should be very easy. So I promised that I wasn't going to hit you with too many of these, but again, show of hands, how many folks use user stories? Okay, just about the entire room. Awesome. So if you don't use user stories, what we like to do is completely throw away the design specification requirements document and replace it with a set of user stories. User stories, since almost all of you know it, I'll be brief, but user stories usually are written like this. Like, you know, as a role, I would like to perform a function in order to, and then that's where you put the business value in. And traditionally, you would put your user stories on an index card or a piece of paper like this. Adam Kogan yesterday said that was like the Stone Ages. Usually you do this electronically. There's lots of methodologies to do that, TFS being one of them probably, right? So on the back, traditionally, you would write your acceptance criteria. So the front, you would say, you know, as an admin, that's my role, I would like to look up customer by customer ID in order to, you know, facilitate the customer service or facilitate a transaction, right? Then on the back, you would put the acceptance criteria. And the acceptance criteria becomes the unit test and the functional test that the testers will do. So you build a bunch of user stories. Now, the temptation with user stories is to sit down and write either what we call an epic, which is a user story like, you know, 10 meters long. Right? If you have a user story longer than 2 sentences, it's probably already too long. And the other thing is to have a stack of user stories this high. So, okay, so all right, Steve, we'll write the short, you know, as a role, I would like to perform a function in order to, you know, obtain the business value acceptance criteria on the back. So, okay, we could do that for our system. But our system's going to be really, really big, so we're going to put every user story down. And my argument is that when you're ready, you should only have a user story for maybe 3 to 6 months worth of work. And you'll see why in just a few minutes. But in reality is you take the most, important user stories for like your major release, and you put that into the system. Then you take your user stories, and you come up with the concept of story points. Do people know story points in the room? Okay, so way more than half, probably 60 or 70%. For those of you that have never used a story point, this, in my opinion, is the transition from moving from traditional methodologies of estimation to an agile estimation technique. In the traditional estimates, we would have a big Gantt chart, and instead of user stories, we would have a functional requirement. So a user story and a functional requirement are very similar. Right? I mean, usually you have this big design document, and you have these functional or technical, functional requirements that map to technical requirements. So your user story, this is the best kind of user story, by the way. Right? Perfectly blank. You know, it means I can just write whatever I want. I could write, you know, asteroids. Anyone play Missile Command in the 80s? Go to YouTube, pop open any video, except Gangnam Style, and just type 1980, and you'll thank me later. You can play Missile Command, a little feature of YouTube that very few people know about. And what's interesting, though, is you have a technical requirement, maps back to the business requirement, and then what we do is we estimate usually in man hours or person hours, whatever you want to call it, or maybe developer days, developer hours. And then that gets calculated, put on a Gantt chart, and that eventually becomes the estimate. So traditionally, for 50 years, we've been estimating in time, a temporal type of estimation. With story points, we are not estimating by anything that actually means anything. We're estimating by a relative scale. Meaning, a story point is a relative scale of something that is an objective standard. Let me explain that. This is what I tell people to do. I say, go do something in your organization that you know its level of effort. Maybe it's something big and complex, like, oh, building a login screen. It's probably a little too big. But the team can have one item that they work on, and that one item is their objective standard. And then the story points are a relative scale of complexity against that baseline. So when you're estimating each user story, you could take the first user story. And the first user story could be something pretty easy in your team's mind. It's something you've done before. It could be, you know, build 5 database tables, or it could be something very, very simple. That is your baseline. It's not how many hours it takes to build it. It's not how many days it takes to build it. It's just the baseline. Your story points are a multiplier against that baseline. So now you have another user story. It is three times harder than your baseline. It would have three story points. So it's a relative scale, not a temporal scale. So it's a comparison. Humans are really good at comparisons, right? If I asked you how many meters walk is it to the toilets, do you have any idea? But if I said to you, how much further is it from the toilet to the stairs? And you say, oh, it's about double the length from the toilet to the stairs. We're really good at that, right? Meaning if I say to you, we look at the distance and you say, that's a, you know, let's say we're on the beach and you see some rocks out or a little island about a kilometer away. And you say, and I say to you, how far away do you think that is? You know, maybe if you're really, really smart or really, really lucky, you'll say 1 kilometer. But if you see another island in the halfway point and you say, how far away is that one? Oh, that's double the amount of time from here to there. We're much better at doing a relative scale than an exact scale. And that's exactly what story points are. So story points give us the ability to have a comparison against the baseline. So now what we need to do is estimate all of our user stories into story points. So the way we do that is planning poker. Has anyone here played planning poker? This would be an easy session. 50% of the people know what I'm talking about. But yet, very few people said they were doing agile estimation. So you have a lot of the nuts and bolts together. So let me ask you guys this question. Would anyone want to work on a project with me? Okay. This is the point. When I do this, like, when I do this session like in Japan, they're very polite there. They all raise their hand. So I like the honesty. That was about 40% of the room. I'm going to stretch it to say 50%. The people who did not say they want to work with me either knew that I was up to something or just realized that I'm a loud, obnoxious New Yorker. Because this is how a meeting goes with me. We're in a room and we're estimating. And they say, all right, we're going to now talk about the update customer stored procedure. I've actually written a few books on SQL Server. In my non-agile life, I've done a lot of work with databases and data access. And so we're sitting in this meeting, and you're thinking, and I'm the boss, by the way. I am the owner, I'm the CEO, I'm everything, right? I am Bill Gates, Larry Ellison, Larry Page, Mark Zuckerberg rolled into one. I own everything. And you're sitting with me in the meeting, and it goes something like this. The project manager, or whatever you want, let's just say project manager for the time being, says, how long do you think it's going to take to write this stored procedure? And you're thinking in your head, that's going to take like all day. That's an 8-hour task. And you're about to say 8 hours. And I just slam on the table, that's so simple. Only an idiot would take more than 10 minutes to write this stored procedure. So are you now going to change your estimate considering that the boss, remember Zuckerberg, everything rolled into one, the boss who controls your paycheck would think you're an idiot? How many people would change their estimates? Be honest. Okay, so yeah, that's almost everyone, because I think a lot of people have stopped voting. That was about 80% of the room. Who would not change their estimate? That's probably better. You guys could all work on a project with me. That's good. You could beat me down. But I might bully you. Like, then you start fighting. So then what happens? I say 1 hour, you say, oh, let's not use it that way. I say 1 hour, you say 8 hours. What's it going to be? 5, right? We're going to meet in the middle. Right? Human nature, right? If you're selling your home and you put it on the newspaper for $400,000 and I come and offer you $200,000 for your home, what am I going to pay for the home? Right? Probably $300,000, right? Humans, at the end of the day, unless you're like a big, mean person, we don't like conflict, right? So we usually meet in the middle. So the problem with estimation today is that big authority members in the room will sway it to their opinion. If you seriously thought it was 8 hours, you probably have a reason for that, that the stupid manager, the loudmouth New Yorker, doesn't understand. In addition, once you said, if you're, you know, the 25% of the room that said they'd stand up to me, you probably still wouldn't get 8 hours, right? We would probably argue and meet in the middle, and that might not be the best estimate. This is one of the reasons why estimates are wrong. So, of course, what we do, we have the concept of planning poker. And the folks in the room that don't know what planning poker is you get a bunch of cards, and the cards usually have numbers on them, and it's usually a Fibonacci scale, because the reason why it's a Fibonacci scale and not like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is very specifically to remind you that this is a not a temporal and exact estimate, but a comparison. Meaning is, okay, so this is, what's the difference between 14 times and 15 times complexity? Right, exactly my point. So, you know, usually start off with baseline, then you have one, then you have two, right, then you go up to three, then you go up to five. All right, so everyone holds their planning poke, and then you go from five to eight, right, then to 13, right, then to 21, right, you know, doing the Fibonacci scale. The problem is you have your baseline, or not the problem, the process is you have your baseline, everyone has their cards, and then you put your cards down, avoiding the problem of the loudmouth setting your scale. So meaning is 65, I'm sorry, like more like 80% of the room said, when I said only an idiot would, you know, take more than 10 minutes to write this Stork procedure, said they would change their estimate. But in reality, it'd be better if you stood up to the boss, like the 20% of the room said, and said, wait, the reason why I think it's 8 hours is not because I'm an idiot, but is because you didn't think of security, blah, blah, blah. The correct answer would say, Steve, you know, you wrote a book about SQL Server, you know, the last SQL Server book you wrote was SQL Server 2008 R2. Things have changed since then. You don't know what you're talking about anymore, right? People have written books and stuff, always like to brag about how smart they are. And the great thing about this, so you ever get one of those guys, a consultant who comes in and goes, we're going to do it this way because I wrote the book on it. And just wait like a week and the technology is going to already be out of date. Well, you wrote the book on Windows 8, but now it's 8.1. Sorry, like you're not an expert anymore. So that is how planning poker works. And then what you do is you put all of your user stories into the product backlog. I'm not even going to ask, because I'm sure all of you work on the product backlog, but I'm just going to go into the world's most popular and best project management software of all time. How many people here use some fancy project management software? Okay, not that many, about 20%. How many people are just sick of me asking you questions? Okay, that's fair. I will, every time I ask a question, and say, show of hands, you can also clap. Right, and that will remind me to stop asking questions. I guess don't come to John and I's next session because it's all about audience participation. Where is the back? The space key. Though you guys seem to like to participate, just don't like the questions. So we're just going to call this maybe ID. And of course, this needs to be raised 4,000% so everyone in the back can see it. Wow, that was unacceptably weird. So that means I need to go like this. It literally is just a blank Excel sheet. And I can't seem to get the zoom to work, but it says 160%. But you can work with it. So now I have to type this way. So we have ID, and we have the story. Yeah, that's how I type story when I'm in a room of 100 people. Actually, I use an Android phone, and autocorrect, now we have the swipe, and autocorrect is getting worse. And that actually is what story would look like if I actually used the swipe to say on my Android phone. But here we would say the points. I can actually type points in. Right, so you know, you have story ID 1, here's the story name, and we'd get, you know, this would be 7 points. You get the drift. So this is what, you know, this is what the backlog would look like. Very straightforward. I know I'm in the back, you can't see it, but I cannot seem to, for some strange reason, I can't seem to get it back. Okay, so now I'm going to attempt to get back to the slideshow on the same slide, which they have this wonderful new feature, says resume from slide. So we have everything in the product backlog. Most everyone does some variation of what I have already discussed, meaning a lot of people in the room are either nodding or falling asleep, which is good, because this is where we start getting a little fun. So the first thing you do is you go ahead and do a sprint. And at the end of the sprint, well, the first sprint usually goes something like this, right? The first sprint says, okay, we are going to take out 10 story points worth of work. So not 10 user stories, but 10 story points worth of work. And the reason why we're going to do that is it's a 2-week sprint. We have the baseline. So remember how we got our story points. A story point of 1 was a baseline the team agreed on. Right? Something, a unit of work that the team knows how long and how complex it is to do. All the user stories are then measured against that baseline. This is, if you really don't remember much from this session, that is the one thing you need to remember about agile estimation, is that is not measuring time, it's measuring level of complexity against the baseline. It's a relative scale, right? Not a temporal scale. So you have, let's say, a bunch of user stories. Those user stories can be broken down into these story points. And what will happen next is you will then take, you know, 10 seems a little short, but let's just use 10 because the number 10 is easy. You take 10 items worth of work out of the backlog. So 10 story points worth of work. And how many of those do you complete in the first sprint? 3. I heard 0. 0 is very aggressive. What type of software do you work on with 0? I would like to hear that later. That's interesting. Someone said 3. Someone said 5. This is usually when I would ask the audience to raise their hand. I didn't. Whoa, you guys are clapping. I didn't say the word. I said, clap if I ask you to raise your hands. I said, this would be one of those situations where I would, but I have reframed. Like a chimpanzee, I am learning. I'm reacting to the audience stimulus. So I think we've established a trust now between the speaker and the audience, which later I have a demo where I need someone to give me their credit card number. So I think we've established that trust. If we haven't gotten there yet, give me 10 more minutes. I think we'll have the trust. So if you work on his team, who's the guy that said 0? Now they're not willing to admit it. Someone on this side of the room said 0. Perfectly acceptable answer. Their velocity would be what? Take a guess if you don't know velocity. 0. Someone over here said 3. At the end of the first sprint, they did 3 story points. What would their velocity be? 3. Right. So for the folks in the room that don't know velocity, it's a very simple number. It is the amount of story points on average the team completes per sprint. So this is one of the reasons why I get psychotic with scrum masters and product owners about only having your sprints of the, not only, but keeping your sprints the same duration. If you do your first sprint to be 13 days, well then every sprint should be 13 days. Because your agile estimation stops to work. I could care less how long you make your sprint or your iteration. What I do care about is that you keep it the same for each iteration. So what will happen is if you have 2-week iterations or 2-week sprints and you can do 10 story, you take out 10 and you completed 3. So on the next sprint, how many do you think you will complete if you did 3 on the first sprint? 3, maybe 4, right? So your velocity will probably be about the same. Because what usually happens is you work a little harder the second sprint, and then the third sprint you go back to the average, and when you average, it takes about 3 sprints, maybe 4 to average out. But it's usually very similar to that very first sprint. But sometimes the first sprint is unnecessarily a little longer. So your velocity is a number that is the representation of the average amount of story points the team can do per iteration. Now, logically speaking, if you have 100 story points worth of work in a backlog, and you have 2-week iterations, and your velocity is 10, in theory, how many weeks until the project is over? Anyone? 20. That is sort of correct. I mean, assuming there's no bugs and or the OBTWs. Do you guys get OBTWs into your backlog? Oh, by the way. Right, you meet the marketing manager, you go to the toilet, and you see the marketing manager, and he's like, hey, I forgot, oh, by the way. I shudder with those words. That's kind of like when I come home, my wife goes, we need to talk. I don't know which is worse, to be honest. It'd be actually, what would be worse is if my wife comes home and says, oh, by the way. Then I'm screwed, right? So that's the velocity. So this is where most people end, unfortunately, with agile estimation. And I asked in the very beginning, I can't ask again because everyone would clap or yell at me or whatever. But I asked how many people were doing agile estimation in some form, and wasn't a tremendous amount, because this is where people usually stop. They put items into a backlog, they estimate it, and then they have their velocity. And just as the lady over there said, you would take the velocity and, you know, divide it by the number of items left in the backlog. So if there are 100 story points worth of items in the backlog, and there are a velocity of 10, we would need, you know, 10 sprints. And if our sprints are 2 weeks, we estimate that this is 20. The problem is that's always wrong. And What now comes out is it's time to start thinking of re-estimation. So at the end of every iteration, it's time to go in and look at the backlog and do a few things. And this is a job now first for the product owner. And I was actually at breakfast this morning with a couple colleagues, and we were talking about the role of the product owner. And I said to them that the product owner's engagement is an indication of how successful your project is going to be. The higher the level of engagement of the product owner, the more successful that your project is going to be. A disengaged product owner is one of the surefire, you know, paths to doom and destruction and failure. So now you sit down or stand, however you choose to do it, with the product owner. And the first thing that he or she will do is reprioritize the backlog. Because after the first iteration, what always happens is they go, oh, by the way, of course, and things like that. But now that they can see the actual product itself, even though it's, you know, one iteration, and they envisioned it to be this big blue website, and you've built a website that's not big and blue, it's yellow or green, whatever it is. They want to, now that they can see things, they will start reprioritizing. Now that you, as a development team, have actually, you know, opened up the code, started lurking on the database, whatever it is that you're doing so far, now that the development team has made that progress, what's interesting is you will start giving them feedback. Oh, well, this isn't as necessary. We thought this was going to be necessary. It's unnecessary. And then on the business side, they're going to do the same thing. So the product owner and the team will collaborate and reprioritize the backlog. The second thing that they will do, and you guys will do as a team, is you will add any items to the backlog and add all the bugs to the backlog that have popped up. Also be an opportunity to remove items to the backlog. Feel free to share with me through a show of hands. If this ever happens in your shop, do items ever get removed from your backlog? I know. Oh, that's a lot. I want to come work for you guys, because at Telerik, nothing ever gets removed from the backlog, ever. Like, it's there for 5 years. And I'm like, can we just remove this? You know, we've changed one of our products. I'm not making this up. We have a product that was based on Silverlight, and we changed it to HTML5. We went through this massive replatforming. And there's still, like, there are still Silverlight features specific to Silverlight or bugs that are in the backlog. I'm like, can we just remove this from the backlog? Like, no, we need the metrics for blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, people are crazy. After you have, you know, groomed your backlog a little bit and, you know, added some items, removed some items, reprioritized the backlog, now you re-estimate the project. And how do you do that? So we're going to actually go off into Excel. And this is where the fun happens. Oh, cool. And goodness, how do I do this? There we go. So I have a, can everyone see that in the back? I hope so. Good. Oh, good, because I can't make it any bigger. I've tried to use the zoom. Apparently 178 is as much as this goes. Ignore sprints 2, 3, 4, and 5. If I was proficient in Excel, and if I was proficient in using one hand here and looking at this screen instead of this screen, I would hide those columns, but pretend they don't exist for the moment. This is a spreadsheet that I have designed, and I've designed it out of necessity at Telerik. Most of you know Telerik as a big, mature ISV. When I got there, there were like, you know, 36 people at the company or some crazy number, and all sitting around a desk, and there was no rules, there was no anything. And one of the things they asked me to do was bring some kind of order to some chaos on some of the teams. And this was something that I devised. So I'm going to walk you through this, because in my opinion, this is how you do agile estimation. We'll actually spend the rest of the session, pretty much, you know, the next 10 minutes or so, the rest of the session, on this spreadsheet. So the first thing is, at the beginning of your sprint, you have these numbers. This 100 represents the story points. So there's 100 story points worth of work in the backlog. So that is the size of the backlog at the beginning of the sprint. So we have 100. So then we said, we're going to commit to 10. And I was a little more forgiving than the two people that, when I said to 10, the two people said, one guy said 0, one guy said 3. I thought I heard someone yell out 5. So let's just pretend we have this, you know, team that was, you know, sucked less than what you guys said. And they actually completed 7, so their velocity is very easy. It's 7. right? In their first sprint, there is zero math. Okay? What happens next? Well, you add the OBTWs, the items added to the backlog. So after the first sprint, there was like this depression. It's very depressing. Even if you did, you pulled 10 out of the backlog and you finished 10 story points, your backlog isn't going to be 90, right? Your backlog's going to be like 120, right? Because after that first sprint, the product owner has like this epiphany. Oh my God, I forgot this, and just gives you this list a mile long. So all those things need to have planning poker assigned to, you know, they have to write user stories, do a planning poker, and then estimate it, put into the backlog, and prioritized. So now you have, I'm just being generous here, but we've added 5 items to the backlog, right? So we've also added a bug. Bugs are not automatically done in this particular process. I mean, you can design any process you like. But bugs are not automatically kind of given. So in this particular case, the bug is just added to the backlog. And nothing was removed from the backlog. You know, items don't start getting removed from the backlog probably several iterations later. So this is where we are right now if you're following along. I see a lot of you taking pictures. I have put this on the internet several times, if you Google it, but I can also put up my email or blog or something and you can also get it from me. I've been meaning to put this on GitHub for like the longest time, and I haven't. I've been lazy, but I will go do that as well. But it's this exact spreadsheet, because I've spoken at a couple of tech eds before, should be out on the internet already. If you Google my name, Agile Estimation. If you can't find it, tonight I will upload it like to somewhere, and then you should be able to get it. But I'll leave you some contact information so that you don't have to take as many of the photos. So what happens is we haven't added anything. So you say sprint estimate to completion. So what we do with sprint estimate to completion, I mean, if you want to see the formula, which is not as important, but all I'm doing is taking the backlog size, what's left, and I am deducting from the backlog size so I'm taking the backlog size plus the items that were added, plus the bugs, minus the number of items that were completed, and anything that was removed from the backlog, right? So all I'm saying is, you know, we take the backlog, we take the items that were added, and we take the bugs, and then we minus the, you know, items that were completed during this sprint, and anything that was removed. So in this particular case, we started with 100, we added 5, we added another bug, so we're at 106, we did 7, so that leaves us with 99. We take that number and divide it by velocity. And that gets us the sprint's estimate to completion. Now you'll see 14.14. That's best round up to like 30. but I address that in the next sprint. And you'll see that in just a second. So the next thing that we do is I go up here and again, this is just a simple formula. You can even see in my formula, but all I did is I took backlog beginning minus what was done, plus we add back in the bugs and the oh by the ways, right? We got to 99. So it's a little depressing. In this case, it's slightly less suicidal than a real project, right? On a real project, you started with 100 story points worth of work, and let's just say you had a velocity of 30. And you're like, oh, we have 70 to go. And then you have like 100 or 200 extra, right? So usually a real project, that 99 is not representative. It's usually a lot higher than in sprint one. I decided to be optimistic. However, we did 7 items of work, and the backlog only decreased by 1. So in this particular case, we got a little more realistic, and the developers committed to 8 story points worth of work. And they were superhuman. They said, we completed 8 story points worth of work. Now you'll notice that this only works well mathematically if you did a good job of estimating. Meaning if you sat with your planning poker, if you sat with your planning poker deck and you estimated pretty well, the chances of that happening are probably about 0. However, one of the things that I like to say is if you were off by a lot here, you're probably, you know, over and under, usually it will balance out. If you're having consistently inaccurate estimates with your planning poker, it may make sense to go back and redo the backlog. In this particular case, I'm pretending that we were, you know, our pros offset our cons, right? We were off by 10%, we're probably off, you know, over by 10% and under by 10%. So we've done 8, so our velocity is 7.5. our new velocity, because the velocity is the average that you have done. So what I do is you just, you know, average the number of items that you're able to work on. We've added four items to the bugs. I'm sorry, we've added four items to the backlog, but unfortunately we've also added two bugs. When we do that number, we haven't taken anything out of the backlog. When we basically say the 99 minus 8 plus 6, right, 99 was the start, minus 8 brings us to 91 plus 6, which is the four items that were added, the two bugs, that will get us to 97. So we've done better. We've actually doubled our throughput, right? We've actually gone down. But now we've seen that our, 13 weeks to completion. So they would say, hey, that makes about sense. Or 13 iterations. So if this was a monthly iteration, if this is a 1 week iteration, you would times it by the length of time of your iteration. That is the only time we bring up time. Hate to use time twice in one sentence. But it's the only occasion where we start bringing up time in our estimates. And the reason for that is we'd never want to equate story points to hours or days. Okay? So we always use iterations. And then at the very end of the process, we say, okay, that's 13 iterations. Our iterations are 1 week, so that's going to be 13 weeks is our estimate at this time. Except we know we're wrong. Right? We know there's going to be bugs. We know there's going to be rework. We know there's going to be time spent arguing over priorities, over bugs. Or, you know, it's not like we finish the sprint, and then we have the retrospective, and then we have the sprint planning meeting and start the next sprint. Unless we work 7 days a week, you need to have some buffer time in between. So I like to call this reallocation percentage for rework and bugs. So in this particular case, I'm going to say, we're just going to allocate an extra 5% to our estimate in order to accommodate for, you know, reworking of bugs and adding new bugs. Okay, so that's where this 0.95 comes in. So I add 5% to that initial 12.93, we get 13.61. So we really have went from a 13 iteration estimate to a 14 iteration estimate, right? Because you'd round both of those up right after 0.5. And now that we're two iterations in, it's starting, if you remember that mathematical chart I showed, which I'm not allowed to say, the chart of uncertainty. Remember that chart, what did it say? Well, actually, I mean, I could just bring up the chart real fast again. How do I get mouse over here? There we go. You can't see it just yet, but I'm going to pull up our famous cone from current slide. And the reason why this is important is, seriously, these are real numbers that are plotted. I didn't go randomly. Is after your second iteration, you're really off by this factor of, you know, like 1.5. So your estimates are starting to get better. So in reality, we're trying to accommodate for that a little bit by, you know, switching our estimates. But that's not what I'm doing in the Excel spreadsheet. Meaning is this number here does not represent, I know you're going to clap, the cone of uncertainty, right? You guys haven't realized, I've just gotten you in the habit of clapping. So when the session's over, you're going to give me like this great round of applause and boost my ego. So what happens here is this doesn't represent the inaccuracy, right, of the cone. What this represents is the friction and work that we always forget about in our estimates. Meaning in a perfect world, if we can just go sprint to sprint to sprint to sprint with no vacation days, with no company meetings, with no, but more importantly, with no rework and with investigation into bugs. Not bugs themselves, but investigation into bugs. So if you are adding 100 bugs per iteration, this doesn't account for it. All it accounts for is the amount of time you spend estimating those bugs and investigating how severe that bug is and things like that. It doesn't actually account into that. So meaning is this estimate of 14 iterations is still off, since we're in iteration 2, by a factor of 1.5. Right? So it could really be, you know, 20 iterations, or theoretically it could be a lot lower, but it never goes in that direction, right? We just put the cone up to give a false sense of security to the boss. Oh, we could be off by a factor of 4, but it could be a factor of 4 in the right direction, right? And wink, wink, nod, nod, that never happens, right? As I said, if that happens in your firm, jobs@telerik.com. Just ask for Steve. So what happens is, this is your new estimate of 14 weeks. I keep saying weeks. Let's just say we have 1 week iterations. 14 iterations, but this estimate is still going to be off by a factor of 1.5. But this is what the numbers are telling you. So the cone of uncertainty tells us that we're off by a factor of 1.5. You can feel free to then add that in. The problem is, your cone might look different. The one I've showed you is the industry standard. You might be worse than the industry standard, or you might be better. If you've never charted your estimates over time at your company and how right or wrong they were, then you won't have any indication. Right? Now that you know that the cone exists, you potentially will start doing it. So let's do this one more time. Really, mostly because it is, I can get the mouse, so I guess it doesn't matter. I'll use it over here. We'll start with number three. And the reason why here is because I want to show one more. Well, let's just say sprint number three is the same, right? You know, we've done eight, we did eight, our velocity actually goes up a little bit. You know, we've added two items, we've added three bugs, but we removed two items from the backlog. When we do the math, it gives us 12, which is cool. We now are still doing we're adding 5% for rework, for allocation, and then that brings us to, you know, 12.63, which is really about 13 iterations. So, you know, we're doing pretty good. Now, of course, our cone, right, our mathematical chart, which I'm not allowed to say anymore, says that we're much more accurate, only off by a factor of 0.7, let's say. So you can start representing that to the boss. What's more important, the reason why I'm going to go to sprint four, is we're still doing the same math. In this particular case, you know, we've either gotten faster or maybe, I don't know, added a team member, who knows. But now we're doing 9, so our velocity is up to 8. You know, we've done 1-0, by the way, we've done 2 bugs, and we've taken one extra item out of the backlog. It brings us down to 10.63. But you'll notice I increase the size of this equation as the project goes forward, right? So instead of adding 5%, I'm adding 10%. And here I'm adding 15%. The reason why it increases is as the project goes forward, there's more opportunities for that friction and rework. I know it sounds counterproductive, right? But as a product moves forward, there's more overhead on that product, of that project, right? There's more meetings to go to that are just outside of the scope of the Scrum methodology. There's more bugs to kind of cull through. There's more, you know, there's more of these things that you do. So I actually increase this number. I actually increase it out, if I was doing this a little further, I even increase it out to about 20% as we start getting lower. And it's really more of a buffer. And we found that it gets pretty accurate. Because then when you start thinking of the cone of uncertainty, is you guys are good. When you start thinking of the cone, what happens is now that we're in sprint number five, if we bring that back up, it tells us that at sprint number five, we're pretty much dead on. Okay, so I'm going to actually go back into the slideshow if I can figure that out from current slide. We're pretty much, after 5 iterations, history tells us we're about here. Right? So our estimates are pretty good. So if you keep your iteration short, after 10 weeks, you can start going to the boss and saying, hey, this is 10 weeks old. And we initially said it was going to be here, but now we think it's here. And you have the spreadsheet, and you go, and you now have the ability to make a better estimate. So before we conclude, because we're just about done, and let me just fast forward to the slide that we were on. Velocity, re-estimation. This is the slide that we're on. And before we go, I have two things to mention. Well, first, I can leave this up so because I see people taking pictures. This is a little fast forward, but these are just some of the books that I've read and recommended. One of my colleagues on the board of the Scrum Alliance, Mike Cohn, has written the two kind of most important books on this topic. I pretty much lifted almost everything except that spreadsheet from him. Luckily, we're colleagues, so he knows I rip him off. Those are two good books that I will highly recommend. And what's interesting here is, while you're taking your pictures of the reading list, if you want to check out any of those books, I want to conclude with what I asked you in that very first question. I said, how many people are here using as an ISV? How many people are here working for like a big company, maybe an enterprise developer? And how many people are like a software development shop? If you have a fixed deadline, and the deadline says something like on July 1st, you have a regulation by the government, you're in the banking sector, and you're going to have a big fine of like, you know, $50,000, $100,000 a day if you don't get to that particular point in time. You can use agile estimation techniques that I showed you to make the estimate, but you still have a fixed deadline. So what the agile estimation techniques can do is tell you how you can accommodate that. First thing you can do is say, well, we're going to miss that deadline by 30 days. If you miss that deadline by 30 days and calculate it by the number, the percentage of the fine that you get for those 30 days, you then have the ability to make decisions. Well, it's going to cost us $5 million, or we can outsource some of this project for $1 million and you know, squeeze our deadline. If we're at a company like Telerik, my company, I can tell you the exact date that we're going to release our next product. All right, like let's say it's November 21st. I just can't tell you the features. So when you have an exact date and you have agile estimation, so you can start saying, well, November 21st is the date that we're going to market with this product. However, you know, our agile estimation is telling us after five iterations with pretty good accuracy that we're going to miss that by a month. Start taking out features. Start reducing your backlog size. Make your backlog smaller and smaller. If you're working by the hour at a consulting shop, you could just keep going back to the customer with that spreadsheet and say, pay us by iteration. Right? So we estimate that this is going to be 15 iterations. It costs X dollars per iteration. Pay us by iteration, and after three or four iterations, we can have that conversation because we're going to have a good accuracy of where things are going. If you keep adding, oh, by the ways, right, and we mess things up, you can go get more money. But you know this after maybe four sprints. As if you estimated a project to be 1 year long, after four iterations, you might have the ability to say, you're going to have to go back and get budget. Or if you're not going to get any of that budget, let's start reducing the backlog. Right? You start having those conversations earlier. So this is applicable if you're in an enterprise environment where the deadlines might be more flexible. If you're a regulated environment or an ISV, you can start taking things out of the backlog. So with that, the session is over. This is the reading list, as I said. Hope you had a chance to do it. We have a session here right after this in 40 minutes. So if you have some questions, feel free to come up and ask me. Definitely the guy with the zero, definitely come up and ask. But before you run, I'm supposed to tell you to fill out your evaluation and win some cool things instantly. Now, I don't know, you know, how you really are going to get a physical device instantly, but maybe they invented the replicator or something like that. So, okay, thank you very much, and see you shortly.